Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories says these attacks are illegal and irresponsible. The Israeli regime, however, says they are a preemptive act of self-defense against a Palestinian resistance movement called Islamic Jihad. The occupation forces say the bombardments could last a week, promising more deaths.
As the bodies pile high in the Gaza Strip, emergency protests like this are being held against the Zionist regime's latest onslaught. The pain and anguish is palpable, and with people who have loved ones braving the bombings right now, silence is just not an option.
Two Islamic Jihad commanders have reportedly been killed so far, as have dozens of men, women and children. Palestinians living outside the territories can only pray their loved ones are spared.
Yes, I have three of sisters, and I have my mother in Gaza Strip. I'm trying all the time to contact with them, but they told me everything is bad in Gaza Strip. We just scared. The children is very scared, crying all the time.
They don't know if they will live until, like, you know, night or not. They say, if we respond to your call, then you know we are fine. If we don't respond, you have to be scared, and you have to call, like, you know, our relative and see if something happened to us.
The West's handling of the Palestinian crisis, juxtaposed with the support Ukraine is getting, has thrown into stark relief the lack of political will on the part of Western governments to heal this decades-old wound.
The Palestinian problem has been going on for decades, and yet it isn't told about in the main press. Our governments do not support it, neither the Tory party or Keir Starmer or any of them, not even Ed Davey. Then none of them of the Liberal Party support what is going on. Why? Because it's more important to sell arms and to have some sort of democracy, they call it, in the Middle East. But what I think is happening is they're using Israel to create tension in the world.
Leave the Ukrainian with no armament whatsoever, because then if you give a gun to a Palestinian, he's a terrorist. But the Israelis can have all they like. And they are the victims.
The US has thrown its weight behind Israel, as has Britain. Both say Israel has a right to protect itself, but from what? More than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza have no freedom of movement, sitting ducks for the Israeli occupation forces. In preparation for the attacks, Tel Aviv prevented fuel deliveries to the already impoverished enclave. As a result, hospitals that are only allowed 4 hours of electricity a day will soon be unable to cope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Scores of people were injured and many more were arrested after government forces attacked Muharram mourners in the Indian-controlled Kashmir's main city, Srinagar. Authorities had placed strict restrictions in the city and sealed the entry points with barbed wires to prevent Shia Muslims from participating in the traditional procession. On Saturday evening, authorities issued a statement upholding a ban on mourning processions in the city centre. Police and paramilitary forces were deployed in big numbers to maintain order. Mobile internet services were suspended in parts of Srinagar. However, some mourners defied restrictions and poured onto the streets at many places to mourn the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. The government forces swung into action and hit people with canes. A number of mourners were also detained.
3 decades on, the authorities continue to prevent Shia Muslims from holding traditional Muharram procession in the region's city center, citing security reasons. The people here argue if the government can allow Hindu processions and political rallies in the heart of the city, why not Muharram procession?
See, on one hand, we see the whole security mechanism, you know, they get activated when Hindu pilgrimages are granted permissions and security arrangements are being made. But on the other hand, we see when, something related to Muslims is there, they don't grant permissions. We don't want security at the first place. We want permission so that we could carry out our religious activities.
Very recently, ruling BJP party held a political rally in the city center. If authorities can ensure security for that rally, why are our peaceful mourning processions banned? Why this discrimination?
2 major Muharram processions in the city center were banned by authorities following the outbreak of militancy in Kashmir in 1989. The authorities fear the processions could be taken advantage of by separatist groups to stoke anti-India sentiments and hence create security threats. The religious bodies, on the other hand, term the ban as a brazen attack on their religious freedom.
It is very unfortunate that the authorities are selectively banning religious activities of the majority population here, shutting down mosques and banning processions, even as authorities claim the situation is improving in Kashmir. These days, annual Hindu pilgrimage is underway in Kashmir and all sorts of arrangements are being made to facilitate that. We strongly condemn discriminatory behavior of the government and hope that the good sense will prevail.
The religious bodies have also criticized the authorities for failing to make necessary arrangements, like ensuring availability of essential supplies. They say all promises and claims made by the authorities have fallen flat. Sidri Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side. The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain is on the brink of a recession as deep as the 90s and as long as the 2008 financial crisis, a bleak projection by the country's central bank. The Bank of England says it's trying to stem skyrocketing prices by raising interest rates by half a point to 1.75%, saying the measure couldn't come soon enough.
If we don't bring inflation back to target, bearing in mind the huge scale of the energy shock we're seeing, if we don't bring it back to target, and if we get these so-called second-round effects entering in, it's going to get worse.
It was news that sent a chill among the public, people already feeling the squeeze on their finances.
Leaving out of my home and all the bills on, I have to pay it by myself. I'm on minimum wages as a cleaner, and, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do anyway.
The salary is still the same, and the prices are going up, far too up. That's the reason what I have a concern about is.
The Bank of England predicts the economy is going to shrink, with recession starting this year and lasting all the way through the next. That plus the biggest decline in living standards on record and another sharp rise in household energy bills. The bank pins the eye-watering energy price hike largely on rising gas prices owing to the war in Ukraine. But there are other reasons.
It's a whole plethora of reasons coming together. So you can actually look at the effect of the pandemic, what that impacted on manufacturing and consumerability, global trade and supply chains, and the underlying cost of rising commodities, food and other areas. So this is a Gordian knot of elements coming together. Now, untie that knot, and that's what they're going to have trouble doing.
The writing had already been on the wall. Many experts did warn the UK was behind the curve in dealing with rising inflation. Britons are going to see their energy, fuel, and food bills increase significantly over the next year. Charities are warning of a catastrophe this winter. There's talk of creating warm spaces to provide heated sites for those unable to afford their energy bills.
This deluge of bad economic news comes as the country awaits a new prime minister, and that is a month away. But whoever they may be, their job has just become way harder. Cyper is up London.
The Israeli regime has sealed its crossings with the Gaza Strip since Tuesday, further exacerbating the humanitarian situation in the impoverished territory. Currently, there are two Israeli-controlled crossings into the tiny coastal territory, the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, and the Erez pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza. The crossings have been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007.
The Israel closure of the crossings for the third day has serious, severe implications on the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. We are calling on the international community for immediate actions to pressure Israel to lift the blockade in Gaza.
The impoverished coastal territory already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Most Gazans also depend on handouts from international aid agencies to survive.
Closing the crossing point from the Israeli occupation, it's a collective punishment. It's part of blackmail against Palestinian people. Over 2 million people living in Gaza, they are living in the huge jail. The social and economic situation so deteriorated.
For 15 years, the Israeli regime has kept an illegal and inhumane closure on the Gaza Strip, affecting the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians and restricting their freedom of movement.
Gaza crisis, due to the Israeli continuous blockade for 15 years, suffering from serious implications on the economy, on the humanitarian conditions, the employment, food insecurity, poverty increased to unprecedented percentages.
Tel Aviv's move to shut down the crossings will further complicate living conditions in the impoverished territory. According to human rights groups, the Israeli blockade has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and worsened its humanitarian conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French President Emmanuel Macron has reached the 100-day mark of his second term, and the contrast with the bold newcomer of 2017 couldn't be more different. Macron is being described as distant, burnt out, weary, and hesitant, but the adjective he may like the least is powerless. 2 months into his new mandate, Macron experienced his worst failure as a politician. His young political party failed to win a parliamentary majority. A president used to ignoring the legislative branch so far hasn't shown much political skill or interest in the tough work of cobbling together successful majorities to get his policies approved. Many believe Macron may call for new elections as early as this year or rule even more often by executive decree. Both options are sure to create major opposition in a new parliament as well as social unrest.
Since the legislative elections, France is in a new political era dominated by uncertainty. Macron has been acting as if he can easily find a majority in parliament on a bill-by-bill basis, but I think that has very little chance to work. It's very likely that in less than a year he'll dissolve parliament and call for new legislative elections.
Polls show that, unlike most winners of presidential elections, Macron has not benefited from the usual honeymoon or grace period. Just like in 2017, Macron was mainly elected to block the far right. But he's no longer a political unknown without a track record. Instead, he's a polarizing figure who has been tarnished worldwide by his authoritarian repression of the Yellow Vest protest movement, and who is perceived domestically as wanting very different things than the average person. Economic stagnation is already upon the Eurozone, and depression could be next. Political stagnation appears to have taken root in France, with perhaps even a depressed president. 100 days into Macron's second term, it's a summer of silent discontent in France, with possibly explosive autumn unrest looming. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Black-clad mourners beating on their chests and listening to elegies in honor of a man who lived 14 centuries ago, but continues to touch the hearts of Muslims. Mass processions are underway in Iran to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia imam, Imam Hussein. Iranians from all walks of life have been participating in the ceremonies to pay respect to their imam.
The love of Ashura's philosophy should be gathered and extended in around the world. I believe that because it's not just the love for Muslims or specifically Shias, I believe it's a love that everyone can learn and everyone can understand, because it's not just a matter of your religion, it's a matter of a man that sacrificed everything in his path for his beliefs.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Imam Hussein was a true freedom seeker who stood against the unjust and corrupt ruler of his time, Yazid. We as Muslims remember him every year to safeguard what our Imam stood for.
Imam Hussein was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Based on Islamic references, the Shia Imam and 72 of his companions were killed in the lunar month of Muharram in 680 AD in modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala by the forces of the second Umayyad Caliph Yazid. The asymmetrical battle was triggered after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for he believed that the Caliph did not exercise true Islam as taught by the Prophet.
The philosophy of Imam Hussein's uprising was to expose the corruption that was entrenched in the ruling system. It was only after Yazid's troops spilled the blood of Imam Hussein when people realized Yazid's animosity toward Islam. And that set the start of the collapse of the Umayyad dynasty.
People believe Imam Hussein's sacrifices saved Islam from distortion and manipulation by Yazid. And this is just one reason why his love hasn't died down in the hearts of Muslims after 14 centuries.
Shia Muslims never miss out on the 10-day mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein. They say these rituals are meant to keep Imam Hussein's flag aloft and preserve his legacy for the generations to come. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hundreds of supporters and lawmakers of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf party has filled the streets of the capital Islamabad in a show of support for the ousted premier Imran Khan. They marched in Islamabad's red zone to protest the recent verdict issued by the country's electoral body that declared Khan's party has received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities.
The charged protesters are not only demanding that Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and his cabinet step down, but also warning the United States to stay away from Pakistan's internal affairs.
The demonstrators criticized the role of Washington in Pakistan's politics, saying they are seeking independent foreign policy in Pakistan.
What they are doing to us with the drone attacks, the army men who are killed in our country, they just went for the, you know, the relief work, and after that, the plane was crashed. It is just, I would say, it's you know, they're intervening in our country.
With the USA, some black sheep from Pakistan, they were also involved into all this procedure. That's why the real hero of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has to resign from his office. And now the question is why? Because Imran Khan, he said absolutely not to all their illegal and to all their unfair demands.
While addressing the protesters, Khan underlined that a fresh election is the only way to get rid of what he called the puppet regime.
The U.S. staged a scripted drama for their own benefit in Pakistan, like to Pakistan and its foreign policy. So fresh elections are the only solution to get rid of this government.
On the other hand, the Pakistani government has filed a disqualification reference in Election Commission against Imran Khan. The government demands that the electoral body impose a lifetime ban on former premier as well as his political party. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art, weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's revolution and Ashura. The pain and suffering which Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his followers endured on the day of Ashura were too agonizing, and the harm which was inflicted was very serious. The life of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam is more valuable than everything in the world. The pure and sacred lives of those followers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and the lives of those youth and those members of Imam Hussein's household are not comparable to the life of other people. The bodies were covered in blood and dirt. They made sacrifices and they laid down their lives. The households of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam and Imam Ali alayhi salam were imprisoned. Those events are very tragic and very different to tolerate. But what was achieved on the day of Ashura was so great and glorious that it made it easy for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his followers, and his household to endure the sufferings. This has been narrated by prominent figures.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic Ummah should never forget the event of Ashura, which is a lesson and a source of guidance for us. Definitely Islam is alive because of the event of Ashura and the efforts of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam. And I am from Hussein. This narration means that Hussein alayhi salam continued the path of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and he continued to promote Islam after him. If it had not been for the event of Ashura, and if these great sacrifices had not been made in the history of Islam, this valuable experience and this practical lesson would not have been bestowed on the Islamic Ummah, and Islam would have definitely deviated from its path, as many religions before Islam did, and nothing would have remained from it. The greatness of Ashura is because of this. Had it not been for Ashura, had this great sacrifice not been made in the history of Islam, had this lesson not been taught, and this experience not offered, Islam would have certainly suffered from deviation, like the religions before Islam had suffered from, and nothing would have remained of the truth of Islam and its luminosity.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Islamic Jihad and Israel have agreed to an Egypt-mediated truce. But what was happening in Gaza was a clear Israeli aggression. What other way can it be described when Israel justified its attacks under initially a preemptive operation, which at this point resulted in the death of dozens of Palestinians so far, many of them to have been women and children? Yet the world, which was in an uproar over what it described as Russian aggression against Ukraine, was not giving this as much importance as the brutal assault that took place on Gaza by Israel. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what reasons were behind Israel's assault and why the resistance groups out of Gaza, from the Islamic Jihad to Hamas, were able to show their real firepower like they did during the operation of Sword Al-Quds. First, let me bring in our correspondent Ashraf Shannon from Gaza City. Well, we'll introduce our guest first. We have Mazen Ghumseya, Palestinian scientist and author, who joins us from Bethlehem. Our other guest, Mohammed Abu Sadr, joins us, lecturer at Al-Azhar University, who joins us from Virginia. First, we're going to go on over to Gaza City to get an update from Ashraf Shannon, whom I see is standing in front of the hospital Dell. Ashraf, at this point, a quick wrap-up of the what we understand is this truce to have come into effect, and at the same time, of course, any updates you can give us regarding what is happening on the ground there.
Well, Kaveh, it was declared that by 23:30 local time, that's 20:30 GMT, the Egyptians have reached some form of deal with the Islamic Jihad and the Israeli regime to stop the fighting. But they did not give details of the truce, except for some media leaks about the attempts by Egypt to release Bassam al-Sadi, the senior Islamic Jihad official, who was detained last Monday in the occupied West Bank, and to stop assassinating Palestinians and to ease the blockade. That's all what we have heard about the truce. It remains to be seen 2 hours from now if that truce does hold or not. But so far, the Israeli regime has killed 43 Palestinians, including 15 children, 4 women, and at least 300 people have been injured. The number of fatalities is likely to increase because of the severity of some of their injuries. Israel began this onslaught on Friday afternoon by assassinating top commander of the Islamic Jihad military wing, Al-Quds Brigades, Taysir al-Jabari, and they did that by bombing his apartment that is located within a residential tower where there are at least 100 families live there. Since then, the Islamic Jihad retaliated along with other Palestinian resistance factions by firing over 1,000 rockets towards the Israeli regime. And up to the last half hour, the rockets were still being fired from Gaza, retaliatory rockets, and Israel was still bombing Gaza.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Ashraf Shannon, a correspondent there from Gaza City with the latest. Okay, let me start with you, Mohammed Abu Sadr, regarding what has occurred at this point. Is a truce that has been announced. We have to wait and see if that actually holds. But at this point, the disproportionate attack on Gaza, of which we understand 43 have been killed. You have 9 children among the 17 Palestinians who have been killed just today. What is your reading into the way that Israel went about this assault, of which we will talk also more about the reasoning given, which was this preemptive use of the word preemptive operation, something that did not take place, and yet Israel decided to do what it did, which at this point, as I mentioned, 43 killed, many of them women and children.
Thank you very much for having me. Let me start by saying that again and again, Gaza is under attack. For the past 15 years, Gaza has come under a number of Israeli aggressions, whether a long war or limited escalations as this one that we are witnessing right now. And as you just mentioned, up till this moment, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, around 43 Palestinians have been killed. More than half of them are Palestinian children, women, and civilians. And around 300 Palestinians also have been injured, which is amount to war crimes. Israel has no justification whatsoever to target Palestinian civilians. Even according to international law, when we are talking about collateral damage, it doesn't seem to me that Israel has even a case there, because it seems to me that most of those who have been targeted are Palestinian civilians, children, women, and elderly, which put Israel under the spot. And I think it's about time that the international community stop its double standard policies toward Israel and other and the Israeli aggression and other invasions like the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The other point, let me say that with regard to the scheduled ceasefire, which will go into effect around 11:30 p.m. This evening, it seems to me that Egypt and other mediators, mainly the UN and Qatar, have been working seriously over the past 48 hours to try to put an end to this Israeli aggression against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And from what we had from Khaled al-Batsh, who is a top senior leader within the Islamic Jihad, he has indicated that there is a ceasefire that will go into effect around 11:30 p.m. And in addition to that, many Israeli sources have indicated that Israel is happy with what it has accomplished so far. Israel believes that it has deterred the Islamic Jihad by killing some of the top military commanders. Two top military commanders have been killed and assassinated by Israel. The first one was Taysir al-Jabari, and yesterday was Khaled Mansour. For Israel, that was a big thing, that they succeeded in targeting those top military leaders of the Islamic Jihad. And Israel is afraid that if the fighting goes on, that will be counterproductive to Israel and its Israeli deterrence. So it probably we might see a ceasefire tonight, which have been agreed by both parties, by Israel and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. But still, let me just remind you and remind your viewers, even though that this escalation might reach an end tonight, but Gaza has been left injured with a lot of destruction, a lot of death. The smell of death is every corner and every street of the Gaza Strip. That is a very sad thing for the more than 2 million people who live in Gaza.
Well, Israel says that it is striking, or it struck at this point, in a pinpoint and responsible way in order to reduce to a minimum the harm to non-combatants. Do you believe what Israel says?
Sir, this is a big Israeli lie. There is no pinpoint by targeting Palestinian members of the Islamic military jihad. As I just mentioned to you earlier, more than half of those who have been killed are Palestinian children under the age of 15, Palestinian women and Palestinian civilians. Let me just give you an example. When Israel strike a house inside the Gaza, the Jabalia refugee camp, which is housing more than 100,000 Palestinian refugees in less than 1.5 square kilometers, that doesn't mean that there is no sense in saying that they are pinpointing some militant or some members of the military wing. At the end of the day, we are talking about a place with more than 2 million people, with very crowded and one of the highest densely placed on earth, and pinpointing militant or members of the Islamic Jihad doesn't hold any water here. As I mentioned to you again, Israel is trying to defend what they are doing. They are trying to defend their killing and their aggression against the Palestinians, but overall it's the Palestinian civilians and the Palestinian infrastructure which have been suffered the most as a result of these repeated Israeli aggression against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Why is it that the preemptive operation that Israel says that it went ahead with that notion is something that is even presented and aside from that accepted? Because again, it's an operation, as I mentioned in the intro, of something that did not or had not happened. At this point, what that has done is it has left 43 Palestinians dead with property damage in the Gaza Strip. Talk about an operation that didn't happen and then disproportionately responding to it. That just doesn't make sense.
Well, let me say that Israel is in the midst of its fifth election in less than 2 years. Israel has been going into repeated early elections for the past 2 years because they have not succeeded in establishing a stable government. And the current prime minister of Israel, Yair Lapid, who is serving for the first time in his life as a prime minister, is trying to maximize the number of votes he is going to get in the next Israeli elections, which is scheduled for November 1st of this year. And that's why they went after the Palestinians. That's why they decided to go with a preemptive attack against the Islamic Jihad. It doesn't seem to me that whether, as Israel is saying, that Taysir al-Jabari was planning for attacks against Israel or not, but it seems to me that Israel is trying, or the current prime minister and his coalition, they are trying to maximize their vote numbers in the next Israeli elections on the price of the Palestinian blood, on the price of the Palestinian humanity. It's just saying that that Israel was trying to go for this preemptive attack to protect Israeli citizens or to defend itself. That doesn't hold any water. This Israeli aggression has been going on for many years against the Palestinians, and Israel doesn't understand or doesn't very much respect. It has no respect whatsoever for international law or for international humanitarian law.
I do have to say that we're still trying to get in touch and bring on Mazen Qumsaya, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. As soon as we do get him, hopefully we'll make sure that he gets added to our program here. Mukhabir Abbasada, one thing that is evident is the way that the United States and EU and the West maybe cumulatively have responded to this. And I'd like to find out from you if you agree with the way that this is broken down, in which when you have the White House National Security Council saying that all sides need to avoid further escalation, but then they turn around and say that Israel absolutely and fully, they support Israel's right to defend itself against what they call terrorist groups. Isn't that a way of saying to Israel, continue what you're doing?
This is very unfortunate, what we have been hearing from the U.S. and the EU. Unfortunately, they all the time, they say that Israel has the right to defend itself. And by saying that Israel has the right to defend itself, that basically they are saying that Israel has the right to defend its occupation. Israel has the right to defend its settlement expansion against the Palestinian territories. It also means that Israel has the right to defend its apartheid system in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It means also that Israel has the right to continue its aggression day after day against the Palestinians. U.S. and European hypocrisy doesn't hold any water again. I think it's about time that the whole international system has to be changed. The U.S. And its control of international affairs isn't accepted anymore. It seems to me that the U.S. should have some respect for its so-called policy in the Middle East as an honest broker or as an honest mediator between the Palestinians and Israelis, by saying that that both parties should avoid further violence and further escalation, and in the meantime saying that Israel had the right to defend itself. It's just it just obscured. Doesn't really make any sense. And these double standard policies by the U.S., by the EU, have been very much uncovered by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has been condemned by the U.S., by the EU, and by the international community. And in the meantime, we haven't heard anything from the international community when it comes to Israeli aggression against the Palestinians. And in addition to that, even the general prosecutor of the ICC, who has who is trying to prosecute Russia again for its crimes in Ukraine. But in the meantime, we haven't heard anything also from the ICC when it comes to Israeli war crimes or Israeli crimes against the humanity, the Palestinian territories. Again, these double standard policies, these Western hypocrisies are no longer accepted in our region.
Well, what do you make of the U.S. president who came just weeks ago to the region and visited Israel, and no longer had he touched the tarmac in Tel Aviv when he came down the steps? If you literally took your eyes off the screen and then went back, you saw him standing next to an Iron Dome system, pledging military support for Israel, unwavering military support, even introducing a new type of system that was a laser-type system. Immediately upon touching down in Israel, what kind of message do you think the U.S. president was sending? I mean, okay, Israel is defending itself against whom? Or the only thing is the way that it has attacked Gaza sporadically throughout the years, is what this message in some sense sends.
Well, thank you very much, sir, for bringing this up. We all know that the visit by U.S. president to the region a few weeks ago was intended to convince Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to raise their export of oil to try to stabilize oil prices in the international market, which have soared very high as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We also know that the visit by U.S. president was determined to push up for further Arab-Israeli normalizations after the normalization which have been implemented by UAE, Bahrain, with Israel 2 years ago. The Palestinian issue was not on the agenda of U.S. president. We heard one little sentence from U.S. president when he said that he is still committed to the two-state solution and he is still committed to fulfilling his vision of a two-state solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But in the meantime, he said and stated that the creation of a Palestinian state is just too far from being implemented. He realized that this is not possible, and unfortunately, the U.S. president isn't capable or doesn't want to put any pressure on Israel to put an end to its occupation and its aggression against the Palestinian people.
All right, we're going to end it there. Unfortunately, we could not get Mazen Khumsaya, Palestinian scientist and author, on this program, but we do want to thank you, Mukhaber Abu Sada. Thank you for your contribution. Lecturer at Al-Azhar University, who spoke to us there from Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sure.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.